Hello, everybody. Well, thank you to viewers around the world. Welcome to Things That Matter. I'm your host, John Weston, and I have the great pleasure of introducing a couple of super panelists, and I'm going to get to that in just a second. At Things That Matter, we try and inspire good citizenship and good leadership and hope that individuals can get engaged and tackle problems that may seem a little bit bigger than ourselves. And if I could just share a screen here for a wee sec, I'd like you to see that we're available on various platforms. We're on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter. You can see past episodes of Things That Matter on Spotify and Apple. People really liked the first two that we did at the beginning of last year on promoting peace and democracy in the Taiwan Straits, and then choosing heroes and mentors. So I welcome you to have a look at those. And finally, have a look at our upcoming, our upcoming episodes, which are not viewing nicely for me as I had hoped. But we've got a monthly podcast on the second Thursday of every month on things like character in business and challenges to women and leadership and healthcare issues. So please make sure that you tune in for those. Well, let me introduce our panelists for this evening. I got to know Rupa Subramania at a Civitas meeting last year. She's well known to you as the writer in the National Post, but you can also find her in the New York Times. She has covered things around the world relating to civil liberties, and she's what I call a real investigative reporter, somebody who takes a lot of time to go behind the scenes and find out what's really going on. Carl Harrison, I got to know, a fellow West Vancouverite, somebody who has a successful career in business on both sides of the Atlantic. He started in the UK, where he's been involved in the hospitality industry. He knows an awful lot about getting things done in Parliament. And I helped him get moving a foundation called the Institute for Freedom and Justice. My own interest in this, I'll let you know before we get going, Rupa and Carl, goes back to a sense that it's not okay to be a bully. And we're talking about civil liberties tonight. And sometimes that seems maybe a little bit esoteric, freedoms and civil liberties and constitutions. But it goes way back to when I was a kid, and I used to be the person who would stand up for the unpopular person at school. I was the one who got going the Canadian Constitution Foundation with the help of others when Nishka elders felt that their rights as Canadians would be undermined by a treaty that was passed, the first modern day treaty. And so the Canadian Constitution Foundation was born, which today has grown into a very strong pillar of Canadian society in promoting rights and freedoms. And when I initiated that, I created something called the Institute for Freedom and Justice and left it there for the right cause to come along. And what we saw in the last couple of years was a government that was, at one level, trying to promote health and prevent a pandemic from spreading beyond where it could go. But on another level, we heard a prime minister, Justin Trudeau, say that people who didn't agree with his version on vaccinations were misogynists and bigots, and he even questioned whether they should be here. So to me, regardless of what party you belong to, and we're not promoting partisanship, we're definitely not promoting polarization here on Things That Matter, but that was maybe great politics and very bad leadership, because it made it hard to listen to the other side, to understand when people's rights were being compromised, what we could do to deal with those rights and freedoms. And both of you have come at this from different perspectives. So Carl, let's start with you. You've got a case in the federal court. You spent much of your own resources and a tremendous amount of your own time in the last few years as a new Canadian who has decided that we need to be more conscious of our rights and freedoms. Why have you gone to such a length?
I mean, first, I mean, thanks for having me on your show, John. It's a great privilege and pleasure to be here. I think it's interesting that you started off your comments there by talking about bullies, and I share that, and I think that, you know, that it, you know, bullies are to be discouraged, and once you end up with leaders of so-called liberal democracies behaving as a bully towards people in their own country, then we're normally on a slippery slope to something that we should avoid. And certainly, as you've just dealt with there, that's the route that Justin Trudeau went when he started using the words that you've just described. I mean, I think when we talk about whether it's great politics and poor leadership, I think if it's poor leadership, it's poor politics. And I know that in politics, it's a nice idea to have the idea that politics is something more esoteric than what we're voting for. But I don't really agree with that. I think we should get what we vote for. Maybe in this case we have, actually. But I'm a new Canadian, yes. But I'm a new Canadian. Not that new. I mean, I'm, you know, recently off the boat 15 years ago, I suppose, but I have a very old Canadian root. So my great grandfather came to Canada in 1909 and traveled across Canada by land and built himself a sod house in Eston in Saskatchewan as one of the first homesteaders in that area. So I've got very old Canadian roots. I've had a Canadian family for the last century or so. And so very deeply connected with the country, which is what I'd always seen as a very free country for all the time I'd spent here and what I'd had with my own relatives. So great shock to see as a European, Canada starting to show signs of accepting leadership that goes down the route that we've seen in Europe. And I think when you are a new Canadian, or wherever you come from, should come from Asia or Europe or other parts of the world, or, you know, Africa, we've seen close up dictators and poor quality politicians and abusers of public trust at close quarters. We've only just lost some of them out of Europe, and some would argue that we might be heading down that road again at the moment. And I think as a new Canadian, we can bring understanding from other parts of the world. We can bring that understanding. So that's where I came from with starting to look at what I could contribute. How could I take part? How could I be active in trying to oppose what I saw as the slippery slope? I mean, democracy like fortunes, I suppose. You can start to lose your freedom slowly at first, then all at once. And so that's where I come from on this.
So clearly, Carl, I shouldn't be calling you a new Canadian, but you chose Canada, and I'm just trying to distinguish you from me. I was born here, and I can sometimes fall into the trap of taking my freedoms for granted. You chose the place. And so over to you, Rupa. Now, I want you to consider what I heard leading up to tonight's show from good friends, people who have supported me in many walks of life, who said, John, why are you even doing this show? I mean, it's clear we need vaccinations, and it's clear that they prevent the spread of a virus. Full disclosure, I'm fully vaccinated, I've encouraged people to get vaccinated. And so what is the tension here between the health concerns and the incursions on people's rights and freedoms? How do you see that tension working out? You've written a lot about this.
Thank you, John, for having me on this panel. And it's great to be here with Carl. We've interacted quite a bit over the last few months. And there is this tension between public health policy as it relates to trying to deal with the pandemic and of course, our civil liberties, how much of our civil liberties are going to be curtailed in the interests of trying to mitigate the effects of the pandemic. But, you know, just going back to the basics, for me, I've you know, for me, I find that without civil liberties, without freedom, there is no life. There is no quality of life. So you think back to the tyranny of the former Soviet Union. You think back to what just happened during the pandemic, where many of our civil liberties were just, we thought that our rights were protected under the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. But we discovered one fine morning, hey, you know, you can't go and sit on a park bench because that somehow spreads COVID-19. And so the public response to the pandemic was in the context of a liberal democracy. And that's very important point to make here. I've lived all over the world, most recently in India, and I never thought that Western liberal democracies would get to this point where they didn't think twice about curtailing our individual freedoms in the interests of science. Whatever the science was. Now, no one can explain to me, and no one could explain to me back then what the science was behind, that prevented me from sitting on a park bench and enjoying the outdoors, for that matter, or the fact that kids couldn't play. I mean, so the science, we justified all of these measures based on the science, and we now know, I mean, there's a lot of information that's coming out now, that the science was deeply flawed. It was not the science. We were not following the scientific method of questioning, of reasoning, of figuring out why this was problematic and why were our individual liberties, why our civil liberties were taken away from us. And of course, the ultimate result of this was the disenfranchisement of basically of 5 to 7 million Canadians who couldn't work, who found themselves with on leave without pay. They couldn't work because they refused to get vaccinated because they didn't believe in the science for various reasons. I mean, these are all people who are not necessarily all anti-vaxxers. I have had the opportunity to interact with many of these people. I've spent time with many of them. They're not anti-science. They're not anti-vaxxers. They're just very skeptical about a vaccine that took literally a few months to manufacture when in fact it takes about 10 years for the whole thing to come out before you inject it into your body. And I say this as triple vaccinated. So John, I'm more vaccinated than you are. but there is this tension, obviously, and hopefully we've learned some lessons from this because I don't think civil liberties should ever be compromised, should ever be sacrificed at the altar of the science as dictated by a few elites.
So you used the term anti-vaxxer several times in your remarks. Over Christmas time, there were several discussions around our dinner tables, and some of them became very heated. And I challenged one of the persons who used this term anti-vaxxer, because it strikes me that you either, when you use the term, you're assuming there's only two kinds of people. There's vaxxers and there's anti-vaxxers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, doesn't that cause us to lose something in our discussion of civil liberties when you throw the world into the A's and the B's, or the X's and the Y's, or the vaxxers and the anti-vaxxers?
Yeah.
So what do you think about that? The vocabulary strikes me as driving a certain kind of discourse that as somebody who's protected civil liberties all my life, I find there's something missing there. We'll go to you first, Rupa, on this one.
Yeah, no, absolutely, 100%. I agree with you. And I am glad you caught that. And this is a mistake that I often make, and I'm really trying not to do that. You're absolutely right. Language really matters here. And the fact of the matter is, I refuse to get a booster. Does that make me an anti-vaxxer? Probably. I've actually been called an anti-vaxxer because of the positions I've taken in recent months. So language really does matter, and I think we should be very careful. I don't think it's a binary between those who support vaccination and those who don't. The, 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 the point I was trying to make is that these people, you know, yes, anti-vaxxer is seen as derogatory, which it shouldn't be. And if we truly follow the scientific method, we truly follow scientific reasoning and questioning, we shouldn't be using these terms. You know, we shouldn't be labeling people. And that's labeling people is incredibly anti-intellectual. It doesn't further public discourse and it doesn't enrich public discourse. And that's unfortunate. But the point that I was trying to make is that many of the people that I've actually interacted with over the course of this pandemic who didn't want to get the vaccine are actually very pro-science. That's what I wanted to say, that they're actually very science-oriented. They're better informed than many of us, actually. And that's the point that I was trying to make, that unfortunately they're being labeled as anti-vaxxers when they're actually pro-science.
Interesting. And by the way, I mentioned how Carl has adopted this country. I've heard you speak publicly about comparing Canada to other places where you've lived. And it strikes me that both of you have maybe a clearer filter on the importance of civil liberties by coming here with more objectivity than someone who's just born here and whose parents and grandparents are born here. I don't know if you want to expand on that, Rupa?
Yeah, of course. That's my favorite topic because I think that, my experiences of having been overseas, I was born and brought up in India till I was 10 years old. And my parents moved to the Middle East. And then I came to Canada when I was 18 years old. I've been here since, but then I went back to India and I lived all over and then I returned to Canada. So my experiences of having been everywhere have really informed, have really shaped, my perceptions of the world and, you know, how I feel about certain issues. And I truly feel I'm very passionate about freedom and individual liberties. And I can tell you, I am, a child of socialism, and I'm also a child of economic liberalization. And I remember that moment in my life when we went from not having choice, where entrepreneurship was stifled, where free enterprise was scorned upon, to suddenly finding myself with all of these things that I could do as a 12-year-old. And this was even before I'd picked up a book on economic freedom, or before I discovered Hayek or Ayn Rand or any of the people any of these influential thinkers. I actually experienced this firsthand, and I experienced it was very dangerous when I lived in the Middle East to go against Islamic orthodoxy, for example. There were all kinds of consequences to you and to your family. You could be put to death, for example, if you question Islamic orthodoxy or the state, for that matter. And so I experienced, before I turned 20, before I came to Canada, I had lived through all of these experiences, and I realized how important freedom and individual liberties were. And I when I came here, I felt like I could suddenly breathe. You know, I could suddenly question. I could question authority. I didn't feel like I was committing a crime, that I was going up against some powerful person for questioning authority. And I really felt it was liberating. It was a liberating experience. We'll come to what is happening in Canada. I'm sure we'll come to that a little later on in this conversation. But, you know, really, you know, what I see right now, I'm seeing all of these red flags. You know, I'm seeing all of these red flags that I've seen elsewhere in the world, elsewhere, you know, during the course of my life, living in all of these places. And this is why I'm so incredibly passionate about, preventing, the erosion of civil liberties and government overreach and so on and so forth.
You talked about liberating people. I want to make sure our audience members are liberated to put questions in the chat line, and I will do my best to get to them. You know, there will be people who are watching today who will be very critical of Rupa and Carl and of me, even for having this discussion. And I want them to think about this. Carl, you're a busy person. You have business that unfolds around the world. You're a husband, you're a dad, and yet you've chosen to put a tremendous amount of time and money into supporting a court case. In fact, being an applicant in federal court. Can you tell us what motivated you to do that and something about what that court case is?
Yes, I mean, what motivates it? If you move to a country, it's a big step, right? If you move to go and live and take your family and settle in another country, that's a big step. But ultimately, we're presented all of the time with three options. And, you know, those three options never change. You, when it's an adverse situation, you can accept it. You can, you know, you can try to change it, or you can move. And I can't accept what I'm seeing. And I'm not about to run away. So the only option you've got then is to try and do something about it. And you have to think, well, what can I do? And in cases like this, there's a number of activities you can take part in. You can take part in a political conversation. If you're at that level, you can take part in protests, and we'll come on to that in a little while, I guess. Or you can do what you know, and you can take some course of legal action. And having done that before, I've had the misfortune to have to take action against governments before, so in the courts, and so it's something that's unfortunately familiar. And it can yield rewards. I mean, a lot of politicians aren't very fond of the courts because courts make decisions that affect all governments subsequently. So, but for citizens, it can be very, very useful. And if you can bring the right action. And so in this case, we wanted to bring political pressure through the action. We wanted to be doing something. We wanted to create also an evidentiary record. We touched a moment ago on language and vocabulary, and I think that's really important, and how unscientific this really was. So we wanted to flush that out. We wanted to create a scientific conversation at a real level. And we wanted to do that. So, I mean, the term anti-vaxxer, I think, is, I mean, once you get leaders of liberal democracies calling their citizens names, I think it really starts to fall apart. And that's what we've got to. We've got, I mean, anti-vaxxer is a stupid term. And
so, Carl, I'm going to interrupt just a little bit. Sure. Let our audience know what your court case is, because not everybody.
I'm just going to say now. So, okay. You know, so the court case we brought was a case in the federal court against the restrictions placed on Canadians that were labeled as unvaccinated or uninjected, however we want to call that, who would no longer be able to board a plane or a train in Canada, or in effect would be able to even leave the country, which would be a fundamental right for most people. So we brought an action and an application in the federal court to challenge that. And in doing so, we presented a number of very credible experts to discuss that. And in doing so, those experts were, you know, one involved in the COVID response in British Columbia, very high highly credentialed infectious diseases specialist, the same in Ontario, another of similar caliber, two former provincial chief medical officers, and an expert in the transmission of pathogens on aircraft. So we brought that forward, and that forced the government to present their own witnesses to be able to challenge that. And that we ended up with, I think, 15 or 16 government witnesses. We ended up with 60 days of cross-examination in the federal court. And we ended up being able also to use that evidentiary record in the media, and Rupa wrote about this, to bring some political pressure as well, which resulted in the transport minister and the assistant transport minister, deputy transport minister, being called to committee to answer some questions. And subsequently, the government suspended their mandates and made an application in the federal court to render our application as moot, meaning that it was no longer relevant. So we have a judgment from the federal court at the moment. As far as that particular justice is concerned, it's moot, and we're heading towards the Federal Court of Appeal to challenge that ruling, and in fact, the doctrine of mootness more generally. But so that's where we are. I mean, on the science, I've got to say this, I think there was a real opportunity missed with all of this in health policy. And whilst we had the Deputy Prime Minister, Chrystia Freeland, saying that she saw an opportunity, and Lord knows what her opportunity was, I mean, she didn't explain it, and nobody really asked her what that opportunity was. The opportunity they missed, really, was perhaps to engage the Canadian public in a civil discourse about the biology and about what we've had health policy about these issues before. It's not, this isn't new. We've had issues, we've had coronaviruses before. We've never had a vaccine against any coronavirus. So why would we be surprised that we now have leaky therapeutics now? There's a lot of discussion that could have happened. And the one that was really missed was a discussion around natural immunity, to the point that in court, we actually had a government witness who was, I think, cynically monetizing the pandemic, who was prepared to try and argue that the administration of a therapeutic by injection was in fact a stimulation of natural immunity. And this is a very highly credentialed doctor trying to invent something new to try and head off the idea that your body's capable of dealing with the virus in the first place. And we knew a lot more at the start than the government admits. And so our case really has been about creating a substantial evidentiary record. And that's available to anybody to go and look at. There's 10,000 pages of it. There's 60 days of cross-examination, including a full cross-examination of Dr. Celia Lorenko, who is the woman in the Public Health Agency of Canada who approved the Pfizer, Moderna, and other products in Canada.
So, Carl,
that's a revealing document itself.
What I understand is your case deals with the rights, the mobility rights of Canadians that were imposed upon by the government's mandate. Is that right?
That's correct. Yeah, I mean, mobility rights are protected in the Charter, and what really the government is doing here is requiring Canadians to have a trade-off between two charter protected rights. One would be their mobility rights, and the other would be their right to effectively to bodily autonomy. So you can have one or the other, not both, seems to be what the government was arguing. And we think that's fundamentally, it's flawed ethically and it's flawed politically, I think, and legally.
So let me turn back to Rupa with this question. And this is going to be, I think, characteristic of our whole conversation. There's a tension here. Nelson says in a question that came in the chat line, well, what about the difference between society rights and individual rights? And somebody who, a close friend of mine who assailed me before the podcast, said, well, go back to John Stuart Mill. My right to swing my fist stops at your chin. And your right to be unvaccinated stops at your ability to go out of the house and infect me. And I'm thinking of my beloved sister-in-law and her partner who are immunocompromised. They would say there's a societal right that outweighs the rights that Carl is seeking to protect in the courts.
But let's look at that, John, quickly. I mean, there's a fundamental point there you have to address in all that discussion. You're not injecting a product that prevents the transmission of the pathogen, right? So that's not happening. So even if it was happening, there would still be an argument on the individual rights. Society is a collection of individuals and a collection of individual rights. And the John Stuart Mill quote I've heard wielded around and thrown around all the time in here, and it can be used both ways, right? So I don't think it's particularly relevant or appropriate. But the fundamental misunderstanding would be that by somebody having a course of injections, they're prevented from transmitting this particular virus, and that's simply not true. It's known not to be true. The companies knew that at the start. They weren't even pursuing that as an objective. So you're talking about therapeutics rather than prophylactics. You're not talking about products that deliver sterilizing immunity. All of that. So I'm very heavily vaccinated, probably more so than many in Canada, because I've traveled in the tropics and countries where you require, for personal reasons, you need other prophylactic products. But this isn't that. So I think that argument just falls to pieces, because you're not stopping transmission by having the injections.
And by the way, audience members, I'm glad to say that Both Carl and Rupert have provided us some good resources to expand upon their comments. So near the end of the show, you're going to get some of those links and some of those resources. Yeah. Rupert, you've had a chance to think about this while Carl's been speaking.
Yeah, exactly, John. So I was just going to jump in, and I completely agree with Carl. The point is that, you know, there's been no effect on the transmission, right? We were told that the vaccines were going to prevent you from getting COVID, right? Wasn't that the promise? That's what Joe Biden was saying. That's what everybody was saying. All of the politicians, the public health officials were saying this February, March, April of 2021. So with no effect on transmission, there is no externality. So this is a completely bogus argument. And then Omicron hit us, and we discovered, hey, everybody's getting COVID, including me, by the way. I got it shortly after my third shot. And so, you know, there is, you know, when it comes to individual rights versus society rights, there is no collective action issue here. You know, there is no externalities. So there's no case for restricted individual liberty. And you know, if someone says, well, the externality is hospitalizations, for example, I say that's equally bogus, because we have socialized medicine. That way, you could be, obesity is an externality, right? So, you know, I just find that, you know, the fact that Omicron, about a year ago, we were in the grips of Omicron and everybody was getting infected, and even the vaccinated were getting infected. And so this just that it just so society versus individual rights just completely falls flat on its face, given the fact that the vaccine just did not prevent transmission.
Christopher and others in the audience have been raising points about science. And unless you are a doctor or a biologist, then you have to struggle with this large area of new information that is being thrown at you in the course of everyday news. And you're supposed to be making decisions that affect your health and affect your liberties. And people got fatigued. We know this wasn't the last pandemic. We know there will be another one. We know that we'll be facing these decisions again. So can you give us some thoughts about how the government can share the science, can express its own uncertainty without seeming lame and indecisive, and make citizens feel empowered that some of us will have to make sacrifices one way or the other, but how can we grasp the information, and how would you rate the government's attempt at transparency? It's supposed to be one of the things that we celebrate in our democracy. What would you say? Carl, we'll start with you and then go to you, Rupert.
I think it's a great point. And it goes back to what I was saying before about the opportunity missed. The health issue of this type and scale presents the government with an amazing opportunity to connect with its people on an honest level. And that's what didn't happen. And that's where we end up in this divisive environment. And as you've said, and I completely understand and empathize entirely with people trying to make decisions, we actually do have a well established legal framework around how we make decisions. We have an ethical basis, and there's a great deal of law and a great deal of understanding about how we do that. We have a procedure of informed consent, and really we you know, that's a simple matrix of decisions that your doctor deals with that on a very straightforward basis, and it's an absolute risk reduction basis. It's three basic questions, you know, about any intervention that you have, and that is: does it work? Is it safe? And very, very importantly, arguably most importantly, do you need it? right? And that those are the three decisions around which you're basing advice to a patient that labels the patient to make an informed decision, which is well argued in the Supreme Court, and there's multiple cases around this. In this, but arguably over decades, the pharmaceutical companies, and I have lots of friends in pharmaceutical companies, so I don't know whether that makes me more cynical or not, but anyway, I do. And the does it work part, well, often they don't, you know, and sometimes they do. Are they safe? Well, we get around that a lot by labeling. We have great big sheets that we put in medicines, which explain all the terrible things that can happen to us. And that didn't happen in this case. All medicines, all therapies, all interventions have adverse effects. So we should be talking about that right at the start. And then the third one is, do you need it? And we knew right at the start that this was a respiratory infection, which affects predominantly older people. I'm asthmatic all of my life. So, you know, probably at the end of mine, it'll be a respiratory infection that gets me. But that happens. We knew it was affecting older people at the start. There's a lot of information around younger people on this and whether they needed to have this at all, and particularly around younger children. And yet so many countries, including ours, have just gone plowing ahead with this with no particular evidence that those people either need this or nor would it be safe for them. And we shouldn't be doing that. We shouldn't be. There's just one final comment I'd say. There's a professor in the UK who sits on the advisory body to the government there called Jeremy Brown, who's a very senior professor in London, does respiratory work, and he said it very simply. He said you don't vaccinate a 15-year-old to try to protect an adult. It's not ethical or the right thing to do. You don't do it. And I think as older people, I'm 60 years old, and others, I think we have a right to be, you know, a requirement to be realistic about it. We can't expect, you know, to start protecting ourselves by putting younger people and children at risk. And I think an unwise decision.
So I think, Carl, what you're saying is that the government could have been less blunt in applying its mandate. One of our audience members coming in from Florida is saying right now, just a second, if we had less people sick, then there would be less people in hospitals. And of course, if there's less people sick in an epidemic, then there's less people who will receive the bug from them. So I'm hearing you're saying, Carl, maybe a more nuanced application of that mandate might have been a wise thing. But the government was put itself in a corner, right? It came out with this very blanket mandate. It was done in an intense manner. The mandate, if you recall, was announced 48 hours before the election started, which of course was controlled by the same person as the one who announced the mandate, that's the Prime Minister. So in such a heated kind of a crucible, it was hard to say, well, maybe some people shouldn't get vaccinated. Rupa?
John, so just to tie in with what Carl was saying earlier, you know, governments have not shown, at least our government has not shown any humility, actually. And I think humility is very important here. I don't know how many people read this extraordinary piece in the Wall Street Journal that appeared about a week and a half ago. I remember tweeting it saying, yesterday's conspiracy theory is today's reality. What this piece was basically saying is that repeated vaccination actually abets the evolution of the virus. And this is in a mainstream publication. It is in the Wall Street Journal. And so, you know, while our government keeps saying you've got to get up to date with vaccines, whatever that would be at this point, 5, 6, 7, I think there's this doctor in Ottawa who brags that she's had 7 vaccines. You know, and so the science is telling us right now that repeated vaccination infection, actually, you know, the virus is able to evade this and it evolves. And so the vaccines are basically rendered useless. The point here is, when it comes to things like mandates, do you want a mandate to get rid of the common cold? Because that's essentially what we're working towards at this point. I just think that right now there needs to be moving forward, I think greater humility, bring in a wide range of experts. One of the problems with the way we responded to the pandemic, especially in the US and Canada, not so much in Europe, because when you look at some of the stuff that they were saying in Europe at the same time, you had a range of different voices. Germany and several European countries recognized natural immunity. You could actually get a proof of COVID, the fact that you had been previously infected with COVID as a way to, enter places, get on a plane and that sort of thing. I'm not saying that's necessarily the best approach. I think we should just get rid of mandates. I don't think we should ever go down that path. My point is that at least in some of these other countries, they had a wide range of opinions on the matter. Here, we actually completely disregarded something that is as old as time itself, natural immunity. It's extraordinary that somehow this vaccine that was created within 10 months or less than that, was better than anything that our body was capable of handling. We've had, it just boggles the mind. But having said that, I do think that the vaccines do help certain sections of the population. And this goes back to the Great Barrington Declaration proposed by Dr. Jay Bhattacharya at Stanford University, Martin Kulldorff, and Sunetra Chaudhry at Oxford in the UK. And, where basically you protect vulnerable groups, you protect the elderly, you protect people in long-term care homes, in retirement homes, and allow the rest of society to live. Why should a five-year-old kid be locked up indoors? Kids are very resilient. And we've known this right from the pandemic, yet we close schools, yet we close parks, yet we close playgrounds. The impact that this is going to have on our young people, on our kids, we're going to see that very soon, and I'm already seeing that a lot of people are young children are on antidepressants. I mean, this is quite extraordinary. This is a mess that Canada has created, the government, and it's not just the Trudeau government. I mean, let's face it. I mean, we criticize the Trudeau government quite a bit, but where were the provincial governments, right? Why did the provincial governments get on the bandwagon? Why were they insisting on? Yeah. Sorry.
You froze momentarily. Glad to have you back. You were just saying that there's a lot of criticism of the Trudeau government, and I'm very keen about what you said about humility in government, but go ahead, finish your thought before
the Trudeau government did what was under its purview, right? Airports, international borders, the civil service, right? The provincial governments, why did they get on the bandwagon? Why were they doing this? Why is it that everybody was speaking in the same voice? And that's what is very scary about this whole thing, that all of society was basically, there was very little dissent happening, unlike in the US, where Florida did its own thing or Texas did something else. But here in Canada, everybody was basically on the same page. I felt it was a complete betrayal when Doug Ford imposed a lockdown last January, when we were promised over and over again, you get your shot, we're at a certain level here, we're never going to go back to lockdowns, yet we locked down. And I'm thinking, here I'm following all of these public health measures, and I'm triple vaccinated and I'm now back in the lockdown, you know, and it just made no sense. It absolutely made no sense. And it wasn't the science.
Let me take you up on that, though. There's two things you've said that really caught my attention. Firstly, you said governments should be more humble. And somebody who was a member of parliament like me was, you know, surrounded by people who are professionally not humble. In other words, it almost seems like your role, you're expected to be decisive. You're expected to act without trepidation, without pausing. Do you remember when the Prime Minister declared this mandate and then called an election on it? And he was completely relentless about it. And then your other point that I think is really interesting, why did the provinces follow suit? Well, it was a pandemic, and one could argue, starting with the international agency that tried to lead, WHO, throughout the world, if we got the science right as a species, it would have made sense for us to all act in a uniform way. The problem was no one understood completely the science because things were evolving. And at the same time, as a leader, many thought they couldn't be humble enough to concede that they didn't understand it all, that perhaps a blanket erosion of freedoms, as we saw, was an overreach. Rupa first, and then Carl, I know you're just really ready to jump in on that. Go ahead,
yeah.
Rupa.
Yeah, John, they were being decisive, but they were being wrong. and the Prime Minister completely politicized the pandemic. I think what's ended up happening has been incredibly damaging, I think, as far as public health is concerned, right? You had the politicization of science. As you mentioned, and as I go into my story in the Rickard Harrison case on the vaccine mandate for travel, it was an opportunistic move, on the eve of the Prime Minister announcing his re-election bid, and this is classic politicization of a public health issue, and it should never have happened, and it's unfortunate. Governments, yes, of course, in the face of a crisis, politicians need to be decisive, but they need to make the right decisions. They were completely wrong here, and they clearly politicized public health, and so I think people have lost faith in our elected officials.
And that's a huge wound to democracy. You know, when I think of the Prime Minister, I think of more than an individual. I think of an institution. And it's critical, whether it's the young people who are in the audience today or older citizens, for us to keep faith in the institutions, that somehow there's some duty of a Prime Minister, of a member of parliament, of an MLA, of a premier, to do the right thing. And that means sometimes saying, I don't know, or we need to know more before we sweep away your freedoms and your liberties, right? Carl, full disclosure, I helped you create this IFJ, Institute for Freedom and Justice. I've had the great honor of counseling you in some of the strategic matters along the way. Where do you see this going, this foundation, the things you're doing, the things that Rupa's writing about? Where does this go in terms of the institutions we're talking about? Because I see you as a big thinker. You're not just somebody who cares only about vaccinations. You care about the institutions. You care about the Constitution. You're not a lawyer, but you're more learned about the Constitution than many lawyers are. Where do you see this going?
I think, again, it's a great question. And the government has behaved all around this in an intensely legal way, right? And I think that's something to take note of. And some of the bad faith that's happened from government and the lack of humility.
You said in an intensely legal way. Did you mean that?
Yeah, I do. They behaved in an intensely legal way, and knowing that most people wouldn't necessarily comprehend a lot of the moves they were making and the way they were using the legislation that was available to them once they had an emergency, and the way they were using the way they're looking at the charter. I mean, there's a lot to unpack in the question, but I mean coming from an old country, I come from England, obviously, as you can hear. And so it's an old country with a very long-standing legal system and it's an older democracy. And we sit north of an older democracy as well. And we shouldn't forget that. And we should perhaps have a different view of America as well, which is as argumentative as England. But I come from an old country, and there's an intense political connection between people and the government there. And also, perhaps more also on the legal, in the terms of their understanding and use of the legal system as well. And that was my experience of living there, certainly. And it's perhaps not to be a surprise that a younger democracy like Canada we've got a constitution that's barely 40 years old here, as opposed to a democracy that might be 300 years old. We don't have a constitution on the same basis. We have a charter which was constructed in a different way. So we can't compare it readily to the US Constitution. And I listened to a conversation between Jordan Peterson and Rex Murphy where they got into this, and Jordan Peterson was talking about how about the US Constitution came around and the time it came about and who did it, and a bunch of cynical men at the time putting together a document that was intended to protect the citizens against equally cynical men later. And that's one good way to look at it. What we have is a much younger constitution and charter, which comes from a different background. It comes from provincial governments arguing with a federal prime minister at the time over the contents of a document driven by international treaties, driven by the UN Declaration on Human Rights, and driven by the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, and the content of those and a requirement to comply with those. So it's not simply that somebody pulled the charter out of a bag in, at one time. It was being developed for, the thinking behind it was 20 years before that, from the 60s onwards, as to how Canada was going to comply with its obligations in treaties. But what we end up with is an A3 piece of paper, which we pin on walls, and we're getting it tested at the moment quite heavily, and particularly in relation to some sections of it, and a peculiar section that we have, which again doesn't exist in the US Constitution, which is an emergency provision in the form of Section 1. Which is a get out for government. So what we're doing is reasonable in the circumstances at the moment, and because it's reasonable, we're able to subjugate your rights. But that does not mean they shouldn't behave in a responsible manner towards citizens, and as you guys have said, in a matter of humility towards their job. And John, you talk about the office of prime minister and the institution that lives in the man and how important that is. And in this particular case, what our court case showed was that there was no advice from Public Health Agency of Canada or Health Canada for the government to bring in the mandate for travel that we were challenging. That came out in cross-examination. There was no government witness who would confirm that those agencies advised the government to do that.
So that's astonishing. And
the politicization, as you guys have said, we've got a pandemic going on. We've got health consequences for older people that are quite severe in some cases. We've got some challenges to the health system, and our prime minister thinks it's a great time to have a general election. I've rarely seen anything more cynical than that.
And I have to say, I was involved as a candidate in that election. So you might think that the words that I'm about to speak come out of the mouth of somebody who's totally partisan and therefore driven by a partisan motivations. Au contraire, my sense was that did more damage to the respect for the institutions than anything I could imagine, because it became a tool in the hand of someone vying for a partisan role to win the election, to cause his party to triumph over another party, for the A's to beat the B's, for us to other the ones who were in an opposition role. And for the sake of my children and their children, that damages democracy. Let's go to the point of young people. I had a fantastic opportunity to be surrounded by a bunch of folks in a chalet over New Year's and over the last while, five young people from all over Canada who are doing great things, who really give me hope for the future. What do you say to somebody who's under 30 today, who may be a little baffled by words, constitutional words, by esoteric references to Section 1, maybe they don't know what that means. And I don't want to trivialize them or you or the words you've said, but what do you say to make somebody stand up, to take a role, to be a big citizen and not allow big government, but be a big citizen? How do you, when do you decide to make a stand, to learn about it, to go out and really make a difference, whether it's to run for office or to become another Rupa and write about it, to become an activist like you, Carl, to expend your money and your time? How do you make the decision to say the government's on the wrong track? Because you've mentioned deference to government as a real Canadian thing, and the lack of humility in government. Well, what do we do? What's your advice to young persons? First you, Carl, and then you, Rupa.
Get involved. I mean, we've as you know, John formed a charitable foundation called the Institute for Freedom of Justice, and one of the issues that we want to pursue there is in education and is in providing forums for young people to start to become aware of this and to argue about it and talk about it and to discover debate, which seems to be being stifled in Canada, unfortunately. But we need freedom of speech, we need open debate. So that's certainly something that we can be doing. And to have a reasonable degree, I mean, it sounds awful, but have a reasonable degree of cynicism towards government. Don't just assume that what you're being told is true or is factual, as quite often it's not going to be. So be investigative and find out for yourself. And that's a challenge with, you know, higher education and schools. Are we giving our young people the opportunity to think as freely as they need to? You know, why is that a 20th century thing? Why is it not being promoted at the moment? So, you know, we have a right to disagree, and that's how we come to agreement. So the start point is being able to get involved. And I think there's lots of opportunity for that in Canada. The political system isn't inaccessible to people. It's possible to get elected in Canada. I think a lot of people have stepped forward and do that, and you'd be surprised you can, either as a mayor or an MP, a provincial MP. It's very possible. I spent some time in Ottawa in September, and I have to say, after spending time in Westminster in the UK, which is a much more intense political city, I sat in the first question period where Justin Trudeau and Pierre Poilievre were facing off, and I watched the Prime Minister sitting there texting on his phone rather than taking part in the proceedings, and then looking at photographs and holiday snaps or whatever it was with the Deputy Prime Minister. And I thought, this has got to be, you've got to be able to, you, people can get into this if they want to. This isn't the highest quality of people in these jobs. I think getting involved is the start point, wanting to get involved and wanting to know more about it. And so esoteric as the charter is and the constitution is, it's not that much. It's very readable, it's very understandable.
Well, and I congratulate you for what you've done as a Canadian. Agree or disagree, you've taken the time and trouble to learn about the charter, which is the umbrella under which all of the laws and the freedoms are supposed to evolve in this country. The Constitution is that. Rupa, what would you say to young people who may be baffled by this whole discussion and may feel they've got so many things on their plate? How do they get involved when it comes to a matter of discourse or action on rights and freedoms?
Well, for one thing, I don't think they have too many things on their plate. I think it's, I agree with, you know, you can never, you know, I think you should be engaged intellectually, even if you have a lot of things on your plate. I mean, I think intellectual engagement is first and foremost, and I completely agree with Carl on this point. You know, back to, you know, what we were discussing earlier, you know, governments need to show more humility. Let's also keep in mind that governments like to grab power. And the pandemic was a perfect opportunity to do just that, not just in Canada, but the US and the world over. Every government tried to do what it does best, which is, you know, try to exert its power and influence as much as possible. And that's exactly what happened here. So we need to keep that in mind. And that's what a young person today should realize, that the government is not necessarily always working, to your benefit necessarily. You have to have a healthy dose of skepticism. You have to be able to question. But what's really crucial here is that we need to have open debate about these issues. We really need to be able to talk about these things publicly. Unfortunately, what we're also seeing is we're in the midst of cancel culture, for example. You know, where if you express the wrong opinion according to whoever decides it's wrong, you get canceled. So if you're a young person, you're witnessing all of this, you get bullied at school because you have a different opinion on issue X, it stifles free speech. And so we're seeing the stifling of free speech. We're seeing the stifling of open debate in schools and universities across the country. And, this is going to be their battle. This is the battle that young people have to fight. The battle that was fought in the former Soviet Union and in Eastern Europe decades ago is going to be fought here, the battle of ideas.
You've said government is not always working for your benefit, and makes the point how we lose trust in government when a government grabs power and seems to do it for its own independent and self-interested ways. Mm-hmm. You've both said that we need to watch the labels. Things like anti-vaxxer can be very damaging because it creates an us and the other, mm-hmm. and it stops listening and it causes polarization. We need to listen to the other side, even to those we disagree with, because that's the nature of a democracy. And we need to stand up for people's rights and freedoms, sometimes other people's rights and freedoms, not just our own. We need to care for our institutions. And I would say that you're both exemplary, even as you challenge what government is doing, in saying between the lines that you care deeply for our institutions. And ultimately, we have to stand up for our freedoms. And that doesn't come just naturally. And as Burke said, the cost of freedom is constant vigilance. So you both have provided some resources for those who want to go more deeply. And let me just bring up what you have proposed here. So if you can see my screen, Rupa, do you want to just tell us a little bit about the things that you suggested here and for people who want to go a little more deeply?
So my reading recommendations these are books that have shaped my thinking. As a young person, I really urge people to read these books. Maybe they've already done that, but the number one on my list is The Road to Serfdom by Friedrich von Hayek. The book basically warns us that even the most benign and attempt at socialism, leads to our individual liberties being taken away from us and leads to an authoritarian state. And I can personally speak to this even before I discovered Hayek, even before I discovered The Road to Serfdom, I'd already experienced this. So when I read this book, I was thinking, wow, this is precisely what I've experienced. And this is, just confirms that what I believe in, that I, you know, and where I want to go based on my personal experiences. So I, you know, I really relate to the road to serfdom in a very, very important way, because it really has shaped me as an individual. The second book that I would recommend is The Closing of the American Mind by Alan Bloom. And it's also very similar. You'll see that there's a theme here. And, you know, the theme here being civil liberties, individual freedom, free speech, being able to debate openly. And, you know, Alan Bloom, again, you know, was extremely prescient when, you know, when you think about what is happening right now here in Canada and the US, you take the culture wars, for example, cancel culture, which is being fought in academia. And, you know, and this exactly is what he was pointing to, that uncritical thinking you know, will lead to a closing of the mind rather than an opening of the mind. And we're seeing this happen all the time. And this is really the decline of Western society, the way I see it, when you've basically closed your mind to, other points of view. And the third book that I would recommend, and of course everybody would know this, is 1984 by George Orwell. I've read that a million times, and again, it's very prescient, and where, you know, you have this authoritarian state that suppresses all dissent, and, you know, where there's a constant rewriting of history, and there's no access to any kind of truth, and all because the ruling elite benefit from it. And this is, again, I say this often in my tweets, we're really living in Orwellian times.
Rupa, you're very modest. You didn't even mention some of your own writings. And what I'll commit to our audience is that these picks of yours will be on our website under recommended reading. I'd like you to give me some of your best articles, which we'll add to that. I have tweeted your articles before, and I think our audience would like to have ready access to some of those things. Let's see if, Carl, I can get your picks on the screen as well. Just a second here. Well, why don't you start talking about them while I try and find
them? I can. I think it's a very good idea, actually, for some of Rupa's articles to go on, to be available to people afterwards. And certainly her article about our court case, I think, is a very a good introduction to what is a very a big case. But I've got some simple picks. Given that we were talking about issues around vaccination and civil liberties, and just looking for a good start for information for people who haven't been diving into it as deeply as perhaps I have and others more involved with in detail. I've pointed to a Substack from Carl Heenahan and Tom Jefferson, they're just two very balanced and serious academics. And who provide a very objective view of some of the issues. And I'd recommend that very, very highly. They relate it to, peer-reviewed research, and they analyze it in a way that's very digestible, I think. And I think that's worth doing. I've highlighted the discussion that Rupa and I and colleagues had with Jordan Peterson, which is a longer dive into some aspects of our court case. And I think that's worth listening to. It includes Bruce Pardy, who's a law professor from Ontario, who has some very interesting views, and also our lawyer, a very talented lawyer from Toronto called Sam Prasvelos. I've put in there the UN International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, which I talked about earlier. And I just think it's really important for young people looking at where our constitution comes from to look at these treaties and to start to investigate how those treaties work their way into sovereign law and how they influence the development of legislation where governments are obliged to follow those. Not because the treaties themselves are bad, but how we manage the process of not becoming a franchised nation. How do we retain our legal and legislative sovereignty in the face of our obligations in treaties? that we want to also work within. I think that's a good start. And that type, you'll see in there there's a lot of familiar language in there, which you'll also be able to relate to the charter. And it probably goes to explaining section one that I touched on. Ray McGuinness's article on the Public Order Emergencies Commission in Ottawa. We didn't speak about the protests in Ottawa, but obviously a very, very important response to the government mandates was the Freedom Convoy, which resulted in the Declaration of the Emergencies Act and a subsequent public inquiry, which is required by the Act, which is due to report next month. And Ray's article is one of the more in-depth ones that I've read. He spent some time sitting there listening, and he's an author who writes about this kind of material. I highly recommend that as an introduction to the way in which that proceeded. And then for those that really are interested in a deep dive into our case, and I'll provide this afterwards so you can provide to people, is the case references for our cases in the federal court and in the Federal Court of Appeal. As I say, it is 10,000 or 12,000 pages, but for those people that really want to start to get into there and start to read some of that material, the pleadings, the arguments, and very importantly, the evidence from experts and the cross-examinations of those experts. I think that's something. One final one, John, if I can, as I threw it in at the end. I think it's a good idea for people to have something I'm reading at the moment. I'm reading a book it's nine essays by Pierre Trudeau. It's called Federalism and the French Canadians, which sounds specific, but it's of interest to everybody, I think, and perhaps shows some understanding of Trudeau Senior, which might be emerging in the federalist approach of Trudeau Jr. That's something, if you read it, you'll see.
Well, thank you for those. And again, to our audience members, you will see links to some of those articles so that's easy to find them. That's part of what we're trying to do at Things That Matter, is give you the tools to become big citizens. And I thank you both, Rupa and Carl, for suggesting those things. I want to thank our production team. That's Dana and Elliot and Amber. And our audience for showing up and for caring enough to spend the time to explore these issues with us. A big theme of today's discussion was character, and our next episode is with Ozzy Jurek, who's going to talk about character in business. That'll be on February 9th. Finally, just hats off to both of you for caring so much for our country and our freedoms and for our future. Thank you, and good night, everybody.
Thank you, John. Thank you.
Thank you, John.